Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site, hcplive.com. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our topic and our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. Subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association's lung.org and hcplive.com homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. And for those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. The United States Clean Air Act passed in 1970 and was strengthened with subsequent amendments in 1990. It's a comprehensive federal law that regulates all sources of air emissions. The 1970 Act authorized the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, to establish National Ambient Air Quality Standards, or NOx, for 6 criteria air pollutants in order to protect the public health and the environment. Ground-level ozone and particulate matter are 2 of the 6, and we will be discussing them today. For your information, the others include carbon monoxide, sulfur, and nitrogen dioxide, and lead. This podcast is a special edition related to the American Lung Association's yearly State of the Air Report. The American Lung Association releases our State of the Air Report as an annual air quality report card that tracks individuals' exposures in cities nationwide to unhealthy levels of ground-level ozone, or smog, and particle pollution, or soot, over the course of a 3-year time frame. The report also publishes a ranking of the most polluted and cleanest U.S. cities for air quality. Our guest today is Dr. George Thurston, who has a nationally and internationally recognized record of multidisciplinary academic training and expertise in air quality, epidemiology, and exposure assessment. He is currently a tenured member of the faculty of the Departments of Medicine and Population Health at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine, where he directs the graduate program in Human Exposure and Health Effects. He received his doctorate in Environmental Health Sciences from the Harvard School of Public Health, where his research was part of the landmark Harvard Six Cities Air Pollution Study. He's been an active volunteer advisor on air quality to the American Lung Association, and we thank him for that. Dr. Thurston, thank you for being with us today and spending your time and effort on us, especially as we start to talk about the State of the Air Report 2025.
Great to be here with you.
So just for a little background for our listeners, the State of the Air Report uses the most recent quality assured air pollution data from county measuring stations collected by official federal, state, local, and tribal governments in the years 2021, 2022, and 2023. The year delay in reporting is necessary to allow for collection of accurate and validated data from these various agencies. The measures are for ozone and 2 particle pollution measures, one for short-term and one for annual exposure. Regrettably, county measuring stations for the data we are reporting are present in only about 922 of the over 3,000 counties in the United States. That means there are more than 72 million people who live in counties where their ozone and particle pollution levels are not being monitored, and as we will discuss, that can have health consequences. According to this year's report, nearly half of the people living in the U.S. breathe unhealthy levels of air pollution. Extreme heat and wildfires contributed to worse air quality for millions of people across the U.S. Particle pollution continued its decade-long worsening trend, and unhealthy levels of ozone pollution impacted significantly more people compared to our recent reports. This year's report found that nearly half, or 46%, of the people in the United States live in an area that received a failing grade for at least one measure of air pollution. That's 156 million people in total. 42.5 million people live in areas with a failing grade for all 3 measures. This year, there are only 2 cities, Bangor, Maine, and San Juan, Puerto Rico, that made the cleanest cities list for all 3 pollution measures. Last year, there were 5 cities on that list. Per this year's report, Let me start over. For this year's report, deadly particle pollution continues to impact communities in many parts of the country. 77 million people live in counties that experience unhealthy spikes in particle pollution. This is the highest figure in the last 16 years of this report. Particle pollution we measure, PM2.5, can have numerous health effects when inhaled. There is a measure for both short-term and annual or year-round particle pollution. Dr. Thurston, please explain why a short-term and annual particle exposure measure are important and describe some of the health effects of these exposures, as well as commenting which populations seem to be at most risk for these effects.
Yes, both short-term standards, in other words, looking at acute effects of air pollution exposure over short periods of time, and the cumulative effects of exposure day after day after day, and the long-term standards. For example, with the short-term standards, children with asthma will get reactions to the pollution it causes. Especially, for example, fine particles and ozone will cause inflammation in their lungs. And that can lead to an exacerbation of their asthma, causing them to have to use their rescue meds. But then in the longer term, it can actually give disease to form. In other words, for example, asthma, the recent studies looking at the Children's Health Study in California found that children who live near trafficked areas with higher nitrogen oxides and ozone levels and fine particles had a higher rate of getting asthma. So there's both the long-term cumulative effects of creating new disease and then the acute effects of worsening and exacerbating the disease in the short term. So it's the long-term effects of pollution are more than just the sum of the short term. They're actually quite different. Now, if you look at, for example, at cardiovascular, short-term exposures to fine particulate matter, especially urban particles with their high sulfur and transition metals content, can cause actually increased risk of having a heart attack. So someone who already has a cardiovascular disease could have it, and it does happen. People have heart attacks on the higher pollution days that they wouldn't otherwise have. On the other hand, over the long term, it's the day-to-day cumulative effects that cause atherosclerosis acutely. Someone who has cardiovascular disease, the exposure to air pollution can cause a rupturing of the plaque and therefore have an abrupt heart attack. But in the longer term, the exposure to pollution day after day after day can increase the buildup of the atherosclerosis and the plaque and then lead to long-term risk from disease. So, you know, you have the acute effects from pollution that are shorter term but can be very severe. And then you have the sort of lifetime long-term exposure and creation of disease and sort of setting them up.
Almost like a ticking bomb flying off.
Yes. Right. Or adverse health effects from the acute air pollution.
Great. This year's report also includes data from the summer of 2023, when we might remember that the Canadian wildfire smoke significantly impacted the Midwest and Eastern states, resulting in worse particle pollution. In the 3 years covered by this report, individuals in the U.S. experienced the highest number of days when particle pollution reached unhealthy or red days and very unhealthy or purple days, levels in the last 26 years of reporting the state of the air. Can you please comment on the effects that wildfires have been having related to air quality, and also tell us if there's a distinction between wildfire-related air quality issues and non-wildfire air quality issues?
But yes, the wildfires are a very serious concern. I think they're, first of all, they're an indicator that our climate is changing, and we're seeing more and more of them every year as time goes by, which is very worrisome. But then also the pollution from that affects, well, the firefighters will get big exposures to these particles, and that can have an occupational risk. And then the general public gets exposed to these wildfire basically biomass particle pollution. And what we found, we did a study, for example, in New York City when the wildfires hit in June of that year. And we saw a big jump in the asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease emergency room visits. Mm. So these respiratory effects, they're very irritating to the lung, and they can cause exacerbations of disease. And of course, in the longer term, the concern is that they're organic materials, hydrocarbons, which can cause those cumulative exposures over many years can actually cause lung disease and especially lung cancer. So they are of health concern. Now, you made the point that what about other kinds of pollution and how does it compare with urban pollution? Because most of the standards that we have are set, well, basically all of them are set based on urban air pollution, the kind of everyday pollution we get exposed to from the burning of fossil fuels, such as from traffic, diesel, trucks, gasoline engine cars, and then also burning of fuels to heat buildings and so on, which are very different particles. And we were, when we did that study in New York, for example, we analyzed the particle composition during the wildfire experiments and then compared it to normal pollution from New York City. And we found that the urban air pollution had much higher levels, higher fraction of sulfur and copper and other transition metals. So the wildfire pollution, while not at all good for you, it doesn't have a lot of the most toxic compounds that are in fossil fuel burning particles. And so actually a paper that a poster that we're going to be presenting at this year's American Thoracic Society meeting coming up in San Francisco, we're going to show our results, which when we looked at cardiovascular disease, we saw quite a different picture. And that was that while the everyday pollution that we get, it's much lower levels than during the wildfires, those particles were associated with increased risk of cardiovascular emergency room visits. But even though we saw hundreds of micrograms of the wildfires, we did not see an increase in the cardiovascular emergency room visits during the wildfires. What's going on here is, while there are respiratory effects, very severe respiratory effects from the wildfires, they don't have these transition metals and sulfur that tends to go systemically in the body the way the fossil fuel particles do. So they're both of health concern, but they're very different.
Very different.
Nature and the nature of their adverse health effects.
So when a wildfire expands to the point where it encroaches on cities, it's a double whammy.
Oh, yes, very much so. So you've still got the pollution that you would normally have from the fossil fuel burning and the traffic and so on. And then you've got added to it the wildfires. But we look for an increment over the effects from the local normal, certain normal pollution.
Ambient, which
we, I think we take too much for granted. We really, it's very insidious, the pollution that we're exposed to every single day of our lives, all day long, day and night. Especially urban dwellers are getting exposed to these fossil fuel combustion particles, which are much more cardiovascular danger than other kinds of particles like windblown soil and wildfire particles, biomass burning, which lack some of the really toxic components that are in fossil fuel burning. But we walk around and really don't realize the importance or the levels, even though at relatively low levels that you can't see, like you see in wildfire, they're having very severe health outcomes, especially accumulated over many years, as well as the acute effects. So I would say, you know, the conclusion we come to in that poster that we'll be presenting is that we really need to look at wildfire pollution differently than our normal pollution, and maybe have separate standards for the two. They're both of health risk, but they are different. So not all particles are the same. The problem is the standards the ambient standards are based on the weight of the particles. And it doesn't say anything about the composition. Mm-hmm. And the composition and health effects vary depending on the source. When I started in this field many years ago, all they looked at was total suspended particulate matter, which was basically putting out a vacuum cleaner with a filter on it and then collecting the particles and weighing them, and irrespective of its size. And then we did studies. I actually published the first study looking at fine particulate matter, what we call PM2.5, in 1987. And what we found was the mortality effects were driven by those very small particles. And so the standards moved from total suspended to PM10, which is the ones that get past the trachea, to PM2.5, which are the ones that get deeper in the lungs. Mm. And actually, these fossil fuel particles are almost all in the submicron particle size, which is about the same size as the wavelength of light coming from the sun. Mm. So these are very, very small particles that are coming out of combustion sources, and they get deep in the lung, and then and they can go systemically and have effects throughout the body. So, the standards are protecting help, but I think that we need to basically look deeper at, you know, what are the particles, what are the sources, and what are the particles, and consider them separately.
A lot more to the story.
Yeah, there's a lot, but we can do better at predicting right. help, I think.
So I mentioned earlier that this report talks both about the particle pollution, which we've just discussed, and also ozone. Now, ground-level ozone pollution is a powerful respiratory irritant whose effects seem to be like a sunburn of the lungs. Warmer temperatures make ozone more likely to form and harder to clean up. After years of progress on cleaning up ozone, some communities are seeing the worst ozone levels in years. More than 125 million people, or 37% of the nation's population, according to our report, lived in an area with unhealthy ozone pollution, which is 24.6 million more than last year's report. Extreme heat and wildfires, which we already talked about, have contributed to the increase in ozone levels from many parts of the country, most notably in central states from Minnesota to Texas. Dr. Thurston, please remind our listeners of the adverse effects of exposure to unhealthy levels of ozone pollution, and what are some of the main causes of unhealthy ground-level ozone?
Ozone is a what we call a secondary air pollutant, and that's because it doesn't come directly out of an exhaust pipe, like out of a car or out of a power plant, but it's formed in the atmosphere from the pollutants that come out exhaust pipes or stacks. And primarily those things are the hydrocarbons and nitrogen oxides that come out from combustion, especially at high temperatures. And so they will get into the environment and the atmosphere, and in the presence of sunlight, they react and form the oxidant ozone, O3. So it's like oxygen, except adding another oxygen atom and making it O3 or ozone. And this is a very, very reactive compound. And for example, you know, it'll react with rubber. One of the early ways that they measured ozone, going back to the 1950s, before we had our electronic methods, was to take a rubber band and stretch it out and put it outdoors for a month-long period, and then look at the number of cracks in the rubber band. And that's, you know, because it oxidized the rubber and caused these cracks in it. And then they could find that it was proportional. So you can imagine if it does that to a rubber band, what it would do to your lungs. And it's very reactive with whatever it hits. It reacts with like curtains, colors. It'll fade colors the way sunlight does. And that's why they've manufacturers now have different dyes that resist ozone, and what they used to call O-fading. And also car manufacturers. Now, cars are one of the big sources of hydrocarbons and nitrogen oxides, right? But they also had, you know, rubber components like around the windshield, and they replaced the rubber around the windshields with ozone-resistant rubber. because they realized that the ozone they were causing was damaging the cars. Unfortunately, we can't replace our lungs the way
we can replace the rubber.
Yeah. So we're stuck with the lungs we have and hopefully try and keep them as healthy as possible. And so at any rate, this ozone is very reactive with whatever it hits. And when you breathe it in, it reacts with your lungs and causes inflammation. Now, for a child with asthma, for example, inflammation is, you know, the enemy, basically, that when they're taking their meds, their inhalers, that's medication to try and reduce inflammation so that they're less reactive to pollens in the air, for example. So air pollution, ozone pollution works, and also fine particles to some extent, irritating the lungs, making them more twitchy and more reactive, and therefore reacting to pollens and having more asthma attacks. We did a study many years ago in one of the American Lung Association summer camps for kids with asthma and in Connecticut. And it was located downwind of New York City. And so the pollution from New York City, as well as the pollution coming from the Midwest, added together, and then you have the sunlight and summer heat, and we got very high levels of ozone. And so what we did was we followed the kids and over time and kept a record of how many exacerbations. We had about 50 kids each summer that did this camp. And the idea of the camp was to teach the children how to be active, to live their lives, and deal with their asthma. And so they had respiratory therapists there for each set of kids. And we saw, you know, what we did was we recorded. Well, we didn't do this. I was measuring the pollution on one hand, and the respiratory therapists and the visiting physicians and nurses who were in the health building would, when the kids would have an asthma attack, they would come and visit there, and they keep a record of that. What we found was that when the ozone levels went up, the number of children who had asthma exacerbations went up as well, requiring their medications. So it was, and I ended up testifying before the U.S. Senate on this back in the 1990s when we were setting a more protective, and did ultimately set a more protective ozone standard.
Right.
Now, I have to say, you know, if those kids weren't at that camp with the kind of care that we were giving them there, that the American Lung Association was giving them, they likely would have ended up in an emergency room. Mm-hmm. But in this case, they were learning and they had great health care. And so they were able to deal with it. And none of the kids ended up having to go, even though we had very high levels of pollution and quite a few exacerbations. None of them had to go to an emergency room or anything. They were taken care of and it was dealt with. And the idea was, you know, again, to teach them how to take their own lung function, to keep tabs on it. So it was a good learning experience for them, and it was a strong documentation of the kinds of effects that can be felt by children with these high levels of ozone and very reactive.
Well, you've certainly told us about how particle pollution and ozone affect our lungs. What are some of the measures that both individuals and organizations like the American Lung Association and some other public health agencies can advocate for to help move these levels of particle pollution and ozone in the right direction?
There's a lot that needs to be done. We've made progress, but there's still a long way to go. And right now, I think the first step I would make is to make sure that we maintain the standards that we have, the high standards for air quality that we have. In the coming weeks and months, I expect that there's going to be efforts to take our standards and lower them and make them, and by lowering, I mean make them weaker. Right. And so that's something that I think we should be very active in trying to prevent the protections that the Clean Air Act gives us not be watered down. Okay, so that's, and there'll be, I'm certain, opportunities as the government tends, you know, to have hearings and things like that for advocacy groups to make sure to try and maintain the protections we have. And then I think we need to still go further, and that is to make sure that we're doing the best we can to protect health. And when we reevaluate the standards in the future, to see if they need to be tightened. One of the things that we found is that there really is no absolute threshold below which there are no effects of air pollution. So even if we have we meet the standard that is required by law, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's, and it really doesn't mean that we're safe from air pollution. Mm. It's a lot like if you're driving a car and you're meeting the speed limit, you wouldn't say, well, now I don't have to worry. There's no way there can be an accident. There's no way that I could die in a car accident or have a collision. You know that you still can. You're within the legal limits, but right. There's still a risk. And the same is true of air pollution. So, and what's happened over time is, as we've had success in controlling pollution, more and more people are living at levels that are cleaner. And that gives us scientists an opportunity to study, well, are there still effects? Mm-hmm. And what has happened over the years, I mean, people say, well, why do the standards keep going down? Well, it's a process of learning and having evidence. As the standards come down and the states meet them, more and more people are living at lower pollution levels, which is good. But then we do studies and we say, are there still effects? And the answer to date has always been yes, there are effects even in the people who are meeting the standard. So now we say, well, obviously that's not sufficient. So we make standard tighter. So it's been a progressive. You really have to have the evidence. It's hard to have the evidence if you don't have people actually living at these lower levels. Mm-hmm. So it's been a very slow but positive progress towards cleaner air. As we learn more and more about the effects of air pollution even at lower and lower levels.
A great perspective to remind us about. So for our listeners, the full State of the Air report can be viewed and downloaded at lung.org/SOTA. Now, as a spoiler alert, the three most polluted cities for short-term particle pollution were Bakersfield, California, Fairbanks, Alaska, and Eugene, Oregon. The three most polluted cities for year-round particle pollution were Bakersfield once again, Visalia, California, and Fresno, California. The three most polluted areas for ozone were all in California and were Los Angeles, Visalia, and once again, Bakersfield. So as already mentioned, there were only two cities, Bangor, Maine, and San Juan, Puerto Rico, that made the cleanest cities list for all three pollution measures. You should take the time to check out the full report at lung.org/SOTA and look at your region's grades. Before closing, Dr. Thurston, anything else you'd like to add at this point?
Well, I think that what you just said points out that we still have a lot of work to do. I did want to point out that, California came up on your list quite a bit of the cities, but actually there are several cities in California that are among the cleanest in the country. We can get along the coast, Santa Barbara, Salinas, San Luis Obispo are among the cleanest cities. So California is really two different worlds. Whether you're along the coast and have good dispersion of pollution there, it's among the cleanest. But then when you get into Central Valley, where you have mountains on either side and poor dispersion, or you get into Los Angeles, and you've got the basin there, which, you know, Los Angeles was famous for the really high pollution, and it's still among the highest in the country. So, you know, what it makes you realize, I think, it makes me realize, is this is why California needs to be able to set its own standards, because it has very extreme problems in terms of this dispersion. That's a characteristic of California that is rather unique, that it has these really poor dispersion areas. And so that's something that California has always had the ability to do and now is being discussed of not allowing California to be able to set their own emissions limits and so on. And they really do need that ability as a state to protect its residents, even more so than many of the other states. Although some of the other states also say, well, we'll do the same that you do,
we'll like follow,
where
right.
I live. But I do think that's something that we really have to make sure to protect the ability of California to protect the health of its residents.
Excellent point. So I want to thank you again for your time today and also for the volunteer work you've done with the American Lung Association over the years. You've mentioned a couple times the things you've done for the American Lung Association. We're very grateful. So for our listeners, if you want to hear more regarding air quality and its effects on health, we have a great archive of discussions on our show feeds, including with Dr. Mark Hernandez, Dr. Edward Brooks, and Dr. Charlene McAvoy regarding indoor air quality. And also Dr. John Baum's discussion of last year's State of the Air report. A full list of all our topics is available at lung.org/lungcast. So be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.